The Jazz Scene Podcast gives an in-depth look at the lives and stories of the musicians performing in Columbus and beyond. This episode features trumpeter Tony Glausey. Tony spent the week with the Columbus Jazz Orchestra for the Southern Theater Concert Series, Ellington, Basie, and Miles. Today's host is Zach Compton, Vice President of Education and Community Engagement for the Jazz Arts Group of Columbus.
Tony Glausey, you're on the Jazz Scene Podcast. And thank you for being here. It's so great to have you in Columbus. One of the things that we're going to get into is this concert that you're here to play with us, Ellington, Basie, and Miles with the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. I'm going to ask you some things about your influences, but before we get into influences, one of the things that the audience may know, but it's interesting and pertinent to remind them, is we've tried to have you here to do this before.
Yes.
In March of 2020, you were here with us actually rehearsing, and then you and I went to a school and did a really cool clinic, and then things got really weird very fast in our country, and we had to send you home. We were at the Southern Theater on March, whatever that was, when COVID began, and at the time we didn't know that it was like everybody needs to be at home and careful, so we tried to move the gig to like a small location with less audience and like still like put a stream on. I remember all this stuff that was just wild. Ultimately, we had to send you home. We brought you back to do one of our early recorded projects, Speakeasy Hot Jazz, which did you know that won an Emmy, an Ohio Valley Emmy Award?
I just found that out upon arriving here this
week. We didn't know that until finally we found out from the producers of that film later. Oh, by the way, we ended up getting an award for that production, which yielded some really cool stuff, like Cornet Chop Suey was a cool recording we did off of that, and it was a good chance for us to learn how to do like cinematic stuff and so forth. And then fast forward, we finally are back with audiences, and we had to have you back. So welcome, first of all.
Thank you.
Your life, when we knew you before, you had not been in New York for all that long. I think just a couple of years since you had...
Yeah, 3 years.
Yeah, relocated. Yeah. And then, of course, 3+ more years later, you know, here we are. Talk about your life maybe then to now. What are the... I mean, you as a trumpeter are so versatile, and you've done so much, just sort of like checking you out on social media. You've stayed busy, certainly, making your own music, playing with others. How would you characterize this time from then to now, just in a nutshell?
I think it's been the most growth I've ever experienced as a human and as a musician. I remember the pandemic sent me into, at first, a huge episode of anxiety. I think most of us experienced that.
Right.
Extreme anxiety, just what's the future hold? And then it sent me into the deepest feeling of presence that I've ever experienced, because there was no future anymore. And I had to do a lot of digging, as many of us did, into the past, just uncovering things, just a lot of time sitting with self, a lot of meditation, a lot of isolation. And it was scary in some ways, but also really good for the soul, really good for spiritual growth. So you let go of the future, you do some work to uncover things from the past and let that go, and you're just left in the present. It was the deepest feeling of presence I'd ever experienced, and it lasted me all through 2020, 2021, as the gigs started coming back a lot more in the summer of 2021, that feeling of presence dissipated slowly. And it's still here. Mm-hmm. I feel extremely present. But there's something about society just moving, all the cogs spinning, turning, and there's always, we're already in the future. You feel that all the time. Things are already, we're already in December, and then we're already in March, and not just with dates on the calendar, but just the way people are magically appearing. Last night on our first concert, I was thinking, how strange is it that the people that work in the theater just show up? There they are at 6, like as if it's like a magic trick or something. It's like how did they know to show up? And then at 6:30, the doors open. Then at 7, the people start coming in. At 7:30, the concert starts. Strange, isn't it? Yeah. All these things are already planned out, and so we have this tendency as humans to be living already in the future. So I think the biggest takeaway for me from these years and from the pandemic was just this increased sense of presence. And that, of course, has affected the music. It kind of sent me back into the depths of improvisation, the depths of live acoustic music. For a while in my discography, in my musical search, I was making some records that are layered track by track, right? Kind of like the way a pop song is produced. Of course, staying somewhat in the jazz and R&B vein, but the sense of presence as I was bringing it to music, taking it out of meditation, taking it out of just existing and bringing it into music, was realizing that that style of making records and those kinds of concerts and certain artists and venues and gigs and things that maybe were a part of my life pre-pandemic just simply didn't resonate anymore. So the pandemic really changed the music in that sense too. And again, I'm kind of bringing it back to presence. It got into the music in a way where the eternity of this moment as is experienced in music for me really only has a few different sounds and feelings, and that scope is narrowing with time. And I love that.
When you were with us in 2020, as I said, you hadn't been in New York all that long, and excuse me if I'm sort of speaking out of turn for you, but I'm just imagining for you, you know, at the time you were 26,
five.
So, you know, as I imagine, you've done so much musically and you grew up in a musical family, and I want to hear more about that. But just on this journey up to 2020, you were on a path that was somewhat predetermined, meaning musical family, go to school, get degrees. You know, you accomplished some really amazing things as a young musician and then made the decision to go to New York. Was a factor in this being at that transitional age? You know, I can recall it's not been that long that I was 25, and you're sort of crossing through a portal of like, you've been on a somewhat of a regimented path, and then your world starts to open up and be, and then that coincided with the pandemic for you,
which it was shattered
that,
the world.
Yeah,
shattered.
Was that timely in your age at the time that you were
absolutely
in?
The scientists will say the brain is kind of fully developed around 25, and I did start to notice less growth mentally, if that makes sense. Like being only 29 now, I can remember being 20, 21, 22 and feeling like my brain was growing and expanding. My worldview was constantly getting bigger, like noticeably every few months. Not to say that it's not getting bigger and bigger now. I'm expanding my consciousness in other ways. But I do think being 25, being kind of rounded off in that sense with that portion of development, being, as you said, in a place career-wise where everything had been building and here we are ready to launch, and then boom, the pandemic happens and it shatters. It was perfect for me. It was miserable at the start, it was anxious, it was confusing, and you just have to learn to let all that go. Let the future go, because that's never been real. The past is living in your mind, so it's not real either, but at least to some degree you think you know it happened, and you can, like I said, do some work to learn a little bit, but you got to let that go too.
Right.
So again, it just shattered everything. Here we are, as we've always been, right here in this moment. And for me, building a career, if you want to use that word, or any kind of musical path out of now is much better than saying, well, I've done this and I have these degrees and I've won those awards and I'm this person from this family. And so that's who I am. And I'm going this place and then I'll go there. And all that's imaginary. What's actually real is right now. What are we doing now? What kind of music do I feel and hear now, today? Right.
I want to fill in some gaps. You grew up in a musical family on the West Coast. You were born in Eugene, I found out, and you kind of grew up in the Portland area. Talk about where jazz was in and around your youngest years, such that you were sort of finding yourself, whether you knew it or not, heading down that path of jazz and its related music. What was the influence there?
Well, we grew up listening to a lot of great music. My parents just had really good taste. And so there was Stevie Wonder playing and Earth, Wind & Fire and Aretha Franklin, all these great, you know, those are 60s, 70s, maybe kind of records. But also both my grandparents, one a cornet player and one a drummer, had been in the jazz world, playing on the West Coast, big bands, small group hits. And so we also had in our little van, it was back in the days when you could have a certain amount of CDs in the rotation, like six CDs. So we'd always have this Glenn Miller record. We used to have Count Basie. My parents loved Ellington, Basie, Artie Shaw. Who else do we have? Yeah, but they really loved this Glenn Miller record. So me and my sister would sing all the solos. We could scat with, we didn't even play the instruments yet, but we could sing along with all these trumpet and trombone solos on these records. We were 5 or 6 years old. going on road trips or whatever. So that music was there. Mm. And again, a lot of the R&B stuff was maybe more present in our upbringing, but the records were on. So we were hearing that music. I started playing piano maybe age 3 or 4, just by ear. And then when I was 10, I started the trumpet. And my teacher was kind of jazz bent. So he was gigging in that world. This great Jewish cat named Alan Kalick over in Portland. So shout out to Alan.
Yeah.
So he's my first teacher, and he got me doing music theory. And he couldn't understand why I was so quick with music theory, but it's because I had learned to play the piano by ear. So everything that was presented to me hit and took really quickly.
There were literal concepts that were locking in with what your ear had already discovered.
I'd already figured that stuff out, and I could play all this stuff on the piano. When I was 12, I started taking lessons. I just did 3 years of piano lessons, and I really refined all this Chopin and Beethoven.
Yeah, I was going to say classical, mostly. Uh-huh.
Yeah, just for 3 years. And then later, as my ear developed and the music really took me more into the improvisation world, then I started transferring some of those things back to the piano. So then they all started feeding each other. I was writing songs, too, when I was little, and then the music kind of started to change. I started writing music for trumpet, piano, bass, drums for my small groups. And then I went to... So it came time to decide to go to school or not, college or not, and what am I going to major in? And I said, I guess music. I mean, it's always what I had done. I didn't really think much about it. And then when I was in my week of welcome, as they call it, I changed from a trumpet major to a jazz performance major because this is where my heart was at. That's where people were calling me for gigs.
What university was this?
This was University of Oregon.
Okay.
Yeah. People were calling me for gigs already. I don't think I'd had many quote-unquote classical gigs, even though I'd always played that music too. It's just what the music was telling me what to do, so I just followed.
When you were at home, let's just say a few years before the decision to go to college, in that formative period where it sounds like you had groups already, you were writing already, was there an influence? Like for me, my father was my band director, so any inclination toward music was that I saw this example just ahead of me. A good communicator, educator. He also valued the quality of your playing. Like it was all about how you played. It wasn't just about having fun in band, but achieving. So I kind of just, there was a gravitational pull through my father. Were your parents, did they set an environment that sort of was like a conduit for you? Like, okay, I'm going to go that way because I see my parents have opened up this door to create or to present or to perform. Like, where was that, or was that mostly self-driven?
Well, they always gave us the green light to do whatever we wanted. They're very artistic people. They both played piano and sang. We grew up in church, so I was playing organ and piano in church. Everybody played a different instrument. I'm the second of 6 kids, and everybody played piano plus another instrument. So we just played music. I don't know.
So you also had a little community,
yeah,
more than just your parents. It was like a little ecosystem.
Yeah, a little
musical.
Eight people now, so everybody's
world.
Playing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
That's so. You probably honestly, you didn't think too much about
it. I just didn't think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
People always say, when did you decide to be a musician? When did I decide? I just played piano when I was little, and now I'm here. I don't
that's
know.
Cool. Like, so then you go to college for music, and you put some labels on things, jazz studies, right?
Yeah, jazz studies.
And what did it feel like? Because at the time, like pretty soon after, you won some grants and some awards, and you got to work with Wynton Marsalis not too far into that journey. Talk about what it felt like going into college, into a structured environment, music. You've declared that that's your career, or at least your intention with your career path. What did that feel like for you? Was that exhilarating, scary? What did it feel like?
I can't remember. I just enjoyed what I was doing. I had applied to several different universities. I think my top pick was USC, and that's a great music program. Mm-hmm. And it's just expensive. I had a full ride to do my school at the University of Oregon. So I chose a little bit out of just knowing it was debt-free, and it was just going to be a great experience. It's a great school, great chance to meet certain casts and play and just get recording experience and gig. I got in right into the scene. It's a very small scene in Eugene, but it's nice. And I wasn't overwhelmed. Sometimes I felt like there was too much schoolwork, but I was just excited to be there and just take advantage of the resources, the teachers, the students. I was just playing all the time. You can ask any of the people I went to school with. It's like I was just busy in the best way. Sometimes it was stressful, but that was mostly the schoolwork. I was just playing. I was in the orchestra, the wind ensemble, the big band. And I was in a small group, a jazz group, and then I would play piano in another combo. And sometimes piano in the other big band. And then at one point I was directing the second big band. So I was in like 4, 5, 6 school ensembles at once. also the trumpet ensemble. That was fun. And a brass quintet. So I was doing all of that because I just love to play music.
Right.
So this is why I always tell people when they ask, when the students or whoever asks about music education, I just say, I don't know, just play. Because I've just been playing music. I don't know what to say.
That's a difficult lesson to get across to music students, but it's a valuable one, which is if you're so goal-oriented or feel like you need to be put on the career, you know, like what are the classes? How many credits do I have? You know, the game of school. If that's your primary focus, you can miss a lot. You can miss a lot of perspective. For me, similarly, my playing experience growing up was more organic. Like, no, I didn't do solo and ensemble. I didn't do all state anything. But when I got to school, much like you, I just wanted to play my instrument. That's why I switched to jazz studies from, I think, music technology when I got there. And the whole way through college, I just wanted to be in as many things as I had time to play in. And I think that's sort of an underrated perspective when you go to school, because it's so easy to get overwhelmed by the curriculum, by the gen eds, by the history and theory and courses. But if you love the music, you have to find a way to keep loving it through college, which can be a trick.
Yeah.
Especially for young people now who, coming out of COVID, there's even less certainty about, like, what am I doing with my life? You know, don't obsess about your curriculum, that's for sure. You know, like squeeze the moments out of the music and about your personal development.
Just play the music.
Yeah.
Just play the music.
Well, not too far into your college career, you had an opportunity to work with Wynton Marsalis. Tell us about that opportunity, and then I'm curious just what it meant to you to begin to form that relationship.
Yeah, it was low key. We got in touch over the phone, and I said, I'm gonna be in the city for like the third time. It'd be great to just have a hang. So I spent 3 days just hanging with him. He was working on a piece for the New York Phil. And I just asked a lot of questions. We played, just spoke, met everybody in his family. We just hung out, and he's been somebody that I can turn to here and there for advice and guidance. And actually, he called me twice this spring when I was going through this really hard time. I was on the road, just rough stuff outside of music that was happening. And it was really helpful to hear his perspective and to have him call me. You know, I hadn't called him, and, hey, like, I need something. He called me and said, man, how are you doing? Are you okay? And it means a lot. It's one of a few beautiful mentorship kind of situations that I've found myself in over the years. And to have people like that, of that stature musically, trumpet-wise, also just as human beings that are there and can listen and give you guidance, it's invaluable. It's priceless.
There's a fearlessness of your playing and your phrasing and your articulating on your horn that reminds me of him. Mm. I wouldn't say you're a carbon copy. I don't think you're like, oh, like, you know, I'm trying to sound like Wynton, but I do feel like perhaps there's a fearlessness on the horn that may be translated through that partnership with him. Is that valid?
It's possible. I also know sometimes I'll hear him say things that I've never heard him say before, and I go, I felt that way too. Like, I think there's a similar maybe philosophy about the music, maybe not trying to play other people's language so much. I've heard him talk about that, and you hear that in his playing. And also, years ago when somebody first started saying, like, you kind of sound, you have some Wynton in you, I remember thinking, that's interesting. I've never transcribed his playing. I've never listened to his records as much as this person or that person. And then I heard him say, these are my 5 favorite players, or these people have the most information in their sound. I said, well, that's interesting. Those are the people that, at least 4 of them, it was Louis Armstrong, Miles Davis, Booker Little, Sweet Edison, and Ray Nance. And other than Ray Nance, who I love, I would have put the other 4 right up in there. It's like, those are some huge influences.
Who would have been number 5 for you?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe Clifford.
Yeah,
maybe. Yeah. But I like Kenny Dorham a lot. And,
right.
And Freddie, I'll put in there. Lee Morgan, huge. Roy Eldridge.
Let's talk influences a little bit.
That's it right there.
Well, I mean, goodness. And it's funny, too, the further you go, the less, like, and it's tough because, like, you meet people at gigs on the break that are just listeners, and that tends to be one of the first questions, right? Is like, who's your favorite drummer, Zach? Mm. You know, or like, who's your favorite trumpeter? Mm. And it's funny because I feel, and it sounds like what you're saying is, the further you go along, it's like dosages, like drops of these people that come through, or not, or it's like a sort of a weird mesh of Sweets Edison and Clifford Brown that you probably can't put words to. But if you had to, like, somehow brain map it, yeah, there's like combinations of things. Mm-hmm. But it gets blended up, and it sounds like Tony Glaussy. It's not like this perfect equation of influences.
Oh, but for example, in the concert, when we play Miles Ahead, which is Gil Evans writing specifically for Miles, as you mentioned earlier, of course Miles is going to come through more strongly than in the other tunes. When we start playing over Green Dolphin Street, I probably sound more like me or like Clifford or somebody else that maybe, you know, even though Miles did that tune as well. But yeah, if there's a Miles tribute kind of moment, or if I'm playing one of Wynton's tunes, of course it's going to have that. If I'm playing Cornet Chop Suey, it's going to have way more pops in it than if I'm doing But Not For Me, which maybe has a Chet thing.
Right.
I left Chet out. Chet was an influence too. So, and then I think these days, my biggest influences are just the people I play with.
Mm.
The people in my band, some of the contemporary trumpet players, like Ambrose, hugely inspirational for me.
I want to ask you about
that. Love everything he does.
Yeah. I want to ask you about current influences, you know, as from being in Columbus and just sort of watching people come in and out and seeing what's going on in New York. As I got to know you, you know, we spoke about some other musicians you were playing with at the time in New York. And as we drove to some schools, I was getting to sort of hear a little bit about your network at the time of who you play with. Do you consider yourself part of a community, particularly in New York, of younger musicians that are carrying any sort of torch or you know, moving the music forward? And if so, you know, who are some of the players? What, how do you think about your role being 29, you know, an incredible player in New York City? Are you a part of something that is a young community advancing the music, would you say?
Probably.
Yeah.
I don't really think about it.
Right. That's kind of what I was wondering.
I think it just happens.
Yeah.
The people I play with are, of course, my friends.
Right.
And the ones I asked to play, and then they asked me to play. And there's really just a small group of people that I feel are really on the same page, or maybe same path, is a better way to put it, musically. Is there a torch being carried? Sure. But all that just happens.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time to see it. So I think we're just in it.
In the middle of it.
In the beginning, yeah. Beginning. There's so many years.
Mm.
It's a whole 50, 60 years left, you know.
And this music is so young, really, in
so
the scheme
young.
Of things.
It's 100 years old. That's it.
That when you try to put labels or eras, like these, this was this is who I would put it as the title of chapter 4 of jazz. It's like it doesn't work that
way. It's all so new. I mean, Jesus was only 60 people ago. Think about that for a second.
Whoa.
Do that math.
Yeah.
That's not that far.
Right.
So it's...
That puts Louis Armstrong like even closer to us.
Yeah, he's three or four people ago.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So it's close.
Yeah. In the context of a big band, one of the things I loved, we had opening night last night, and I'm fortunate to get to play in the band this week, is you, as you said before, you weave in and out of moments that directly honor the music. Miles, certainly, but also some Count Basie, like stomp and kind of quarter note swing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know how to do that. But you also fold yourself in constantly. You know, I don't feel like you're like grappling this caricature moment, you know, and then you come back and be Tony. But you did say when we were talking off mic that on thematic shows there's just an inherent box, for better or for worse. Not that that's a bad thing, but talk in your mind about that box, because I'm sure you play other gigs where you've got to be in a bit of a confined space versus what we'll talk about in a few minutes, which is your new record. Mm-hmm. But let's talk first about the box. Do you like the challenge of fitting in a box and being yourself?
Well, I don't even think it's a challenge. It's kind of like we're in a box right now because it's you and me and there's two microphones.
Mm-hmm.
So if you add another person in, if you want to call it a box, now the box is bigger. There's another person. So now the game of back and forth is like back and forth.
Right.
Or whatever. Back and forth. There's three of us now. So it's just a different play. When I'm in front of a big band and the tune is miles ahead, it's a different play. Am I doing whatever I want? Of course. But what I want is going to be sticking to the melody that's on the page, because that's respecting the music, and playing something in the spirit of the song and the stage, Byron, CJ, or the whole thing. So I don't actually feel the restraint maybe as much as I might put into words. I don't really feel like I'm in a box when I'm there. But when I take myself out, or as I showed you in the car on the way over here, when I play my music with my band, that's when I recognize, well, that's me in its entirety. I've had the privilege and just fortune of being able to figure that out maybe earlier than a lot of people do. Miles figured it out, but he kept changing over and over again, right? That was what was beautiful about seeing his career unfold. He probably feel like he was putting himself in his own box, and you got to liberate yourself from that. and then you get in a new thing, you got to liberate yourself from that, expanding constantly. Mm-hmm. So when I hear my music with my band, I go, that's the fullest, at least for now. And in 5 years, it'll be a different thing. But yeah, when I'm with CJO playing other people's tunes, it's just that's the canvas we're painting on,
right?
It's like if you give me a 4x4, that's what I'm painting on.
One more question on that. You know, the Basie and Ellington aspects of this concert, but also the tradition, like the reason why you would do that is that you know, I think Byron rightly said last night that they each represented sort of like schools of certainly big band playing, but not just big band playing, the lineage of the music. What do those two voices in particular mean to you in your history? Important in terms of your younger years, more important now as an older, you know, a more developed player? Where do Ellington and Basie fit?
Well, I think Basie really was a part of every big band I ever played in. Mm-hmm. Like every middle school year, every high school year, every college year, there was some Basie in there. Not even necessarily Ellington, but there was always Basie in there.
Right.
Something about the Basie band just was so, it was viral. I mean, everybody wanted to hear that. And it has influenced everybody. Of course, it went to Thad Jones' band, and it's inspired everybody since. Ellington came first. Of course, Ellington, for me, as a writing influence, was huge. And the way that he would write specifically for the musicians in his band, the way that those specific musicians, Ray Nance, you know, Johnny Hodges, the way those cats would play, I mean, everybody's taken influence from that, again, compositionally, in their soloing. So for whatever reason, we don't play as much Ellington, at least in the bands that I was in middle school, high school, college, didn't play quite as much Ellington. But huge influence there, especially compositionally, huge influence from Basie. And these days, I don't do much of that. I have the role of like second trumpet in Remy LaBeouf's Assembly of Shadows, mm-hmm. big band. Congrats to Remy, because he got a Grammy nomination for the last record we put out last year. And we just made a new one in June. That's the only big band that I'm really playing in regularly. And it's all original, it's all modern. There's not as much swing in it, but you can definitely hear lineage. You could hear, you know, Maria Schneider's influence in his music, and Gil Evans, and you can hear the Basie and Ellington. It's all in there. So just like with the trumpet lineage, everybody's got some degree of Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis in their sound and their playing. I think all Ellington, Basie's in everybody's music today. So it's just part of the lineage and the history.
You've put out really a quite respectable quantity of records for such a young career. As you approach this impending album that you'll start releasing tracks from in January, as I understand, where do you feel like you are transitioning out of the quote box or the themes or the past directly into the now? Where do you feel like you are with this record? Tell me about what is this record to you that you're working on finishing and getting out into the world?
Well, compositionally, it's just me now. It's what I live in the last year and a half. The first tune I think I wrote in the fall of 2021. And the last tune was written in the spring of this year. And then we cut the record in July. And I've taken the music on the road twice already this year. And then we've had some New York dates. We've made the record in the studio. Mm-hmm. And then we're setting up tours for next year. So the music is just now. It's me, it's emotional processing, psychological, spiritual work coming out through music. There's 7 songs. We have some alternate takes, so it's going to be a few more tracks. But and the way that we're playing is just, it's just communication. It's just 4 friends in the room with their instruments just speaking to each other. And you've heard a couple of those cuts, mm-hmm. and they're very different. You know, you do look at alternate takes, it's a completely different story, because we're just taking the theme, taking the music that's there. Who knows where it comes from? You know, it's being channeled through me in this case, kind of with the lens of, with a filter of whatever life experience kind of opened up that portal for the music to come through. And then when I bring it to the guys, this is kind of how the tune goes, and then we just make it what it is in that moment. And so that record is that moment. That's July 23rd. If we were to make the record tomorrow, it'd be a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. But it's just a moment in time. It's like a photograph. It's just now.
Is there a composition on this impending album that not that you're particularly proud of, because like children, it's like, how do you choose, right? But but that is kind of buzzing inside of you more than the others. One that just kind of hit maybe a little bit deeper for you, one of the tunes that'll be on the record.
I think two of them come to mind. One of them is a ballad called Natalia, and that was a woman that was very impactful in my life over the last several years. And really the way that cut came out is just magic. Mm. And the other track comes to mind is the title track, Awaken. And that to me is the greatest composition on the record. It was the first thing we played in the studio, very first cut, and that was the take. We just did two takes of everything. It was a really remarkable session because we had 2 days booked. We came in and played the record down. We said, wow, well, I don't even know if we need to play again. Took a break, listened. We said, I guess we'll just do the tunes one more time. So we did it one more time. And it was so unbelievable, the second run through. We said, that's it. We're not playing anymore. So I sent the guys home, and we used the last little bit to mix. And then the next day, I said, don't come in. And we just mixed with the studio time. So it was really, it's a very special group of people. I feel very lucky to have these guys and that they respond to the music. Mm. I'm really excited for you to hear it.
Yeah, the little bit that you shared in the car, I was like, wow, and it was such a journey. You played 2 tracks. And something that I heard too, and this ties to another question I had for you, is that Latin culture, and in particular, I know you've been to Spain a lot, but maybe not only Spain, Colombia, other Mexico yeah. is important to you.
Mm-hmm.
What's the origin of that part of your story? Did you travel as a child, and you know, what caused you to become fluent Spanish speaker, and what's that element of your life
it's
about?
Crazy. I am hispanohablante, Spanish speaker. When I was 12, I decided enough's enough, I'm gonna understand this, because you hear so much Spanish in this country. I said, I'm gonna figure this out. So I started just studying, and I was reading. I would listen to songs and transcribe the lyrics, figure out certain words I didn't know. Cause, you know, you pick stuff up quick, but then you get, you know, it's like any skill, you hit roadblocks, and it's hard to push past certain kind of levels to advance. Mm-hmm. And then I took a couple of years in high school, but I got through really quick. I think I was like in Spanish 4 as a freshman, and then I did the AP Spanish class, and I was TAing the AP Spanish class. I just moved quick. Maybe it was because of music and my ear was at a certain place, or it was a brain thing with patterns. I'm not really sure. But I took to language, or to Spanish, quickly, and it was a passion of mine. I don't really know how else to put it. It was my favorite thing besides music in school. I just loved speaking Spanish. All the foreign exchange students would always be my friends. And when I was 19, I went to Costa Rica for 6 weeks just to hang with one of my foreign exchange student friends, and just got to know a whole different lifestyle. So humbling. It's beautiful. And then in my you know, touring years, I've been to all kinds of countries. I think I've been to every country in Central America, maybe excluding one, all the way from Mexico down to Panama. And then I just went to Colombia for the first time in August. And as you mentioned, I've been to Spain at least 12 times. Hmm. That's like my home over there. My second home. So the Spanish language was just developing with time, and I've had a few longer term partners, one girl from Spain and one from Mexico. And you know, when you're speaking only Spanish, it's gonna get better.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. I just love those countries. I really identify that. They always tell me, like this woman at the hotel, we just keep running into each other in the elevator or whatever, and we just keep chatting, and she's from Venezuela. She's telling me her whole story, where all over she's been. And she says, like all these Latinos always say, they say, you're Latino at heart, tú eres Latino. And I said, I don't know, I guess I am. I'm not really sure. Yeah. I'm nothing, I'm everything, I'm whatever, but I really identify with Spanish speakers, Spain in particular, Mexico, Colombia. Colombia was amazing. Went to Santa Marta in the north, in the jungle.
Yeah.
So the influence musically, there's influence there. I have a couple of versions of boleros, which are kind of more coming from the history of Central America, Mexico through Panama. And as far as like Spanish influence, I don't really have any flamenco in my music or any other directly Spanish or, you know, South American roots, but it's all in there. That's sometimes people ask me, they say, what else do you do besides music? Like, what are your hobbies? Well, I read a lot, and I like to be out in nature, and I like, you know, I mentioned spiritual pursuits and philosophical pursuits. But then when I think about it, I say, you know, honestly, Latin culture and being in those countries, traveling, that's actually a huge hobby of mine. Mm-hmm. It's such a beautiful part of my life that definitely enriches the music. And who knows what's next? I mean, I kind of fantasize about living in one of those places, to be honest. So
it strikes me that, you know, for somebody 29 years of age, you know, and I told you this in the car, especially even in the 3 years since COVID, you're so grounded in what you want to accomplish. Mm. You're not forcing anything. You're wide open to possibilities. What's cool working for a jazz organization that's trying to sort of, we have goals. We want people to love the music and so forth. And I'm playing the drums. Watching you come in is really special because the audience gets to meet someone who is literally on a life journey with this music in the earlier phase. Mm-hmm. Some of the audience that comes, they're used to, you know, older adults playing this music.
Yeah.
That's what you see maybe more of. Mm-hmm. And of course, because we're so historically minded, you know, you think about Miles and you think about Basie. And then so for this audience to meet you musically and to see someone that can encapsulate the spirit of Miles, Basie, Ellington is really special. And then you take people on a journey. So like, for example, last night, you and Bobby Floyd played the opening and closing to Someday My Prince Will Come. And I don't think anybody could have predicted where we were going to start, where we were going to end. But I think that's what's special. And I think that's what's special about the music is that we have this big band, 17 people that need to be in somewhat of an alignment around an arrangement. But we insert this expression. And I think for our audience to see a young person do that and to do it courageously is really special for us, so that they know that this music is very much alive. And that the students get to see it too. We went to two schools while you've been here, and I've sort of been a fly on the wall watching, and the students can tell that you're a living, breathing person under 40 with thoughts, and the music inspires many of those thoughts. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, those do exist. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think that's special because this music lives on the backs of people like you that are, you're living a life that is true to the music. And I think so much of you, and you know, I've known you now for a while. And I know that the audience, when they see this on JAG TV, you know, if they aren't able to make it for the rest of the run or the clips that they see online, I think there's such a gravitational pull to who you are and what you do. I'm really glad you've been here a few times because that gets you, you're part of our little Columbus
hang. I like Columbus.
And so, you know, I just want to thank you, and I appreciate you coming in so authentically and putting your stamp on the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. Hopefully we're swinging, you know, swinging to your liking alongside of that.
Yes, sir. Y'all swinging.
And just thank you. It's been so much fun having you. We can't wait to see what comes next, and we consider you part of our JAG family.
Thank you, Zach. Thank you, JAG. Thank you, Columbus.
Thanks, Tony.
Ellington, Basie, and Miles will be available to watch at JAG.TV on October 26th. That's JAG.TV. The Jazz Scene is presented by Jazz Arts Group of Columbus, America's oldest nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the art of jazz. Our theme music is titled 3-4 Times by Michael Cox. This episode was hosted by Zach Compton and produced and engineered by Mercedes Aviles. Subscribe to The Jazz Scene wherever you get your podcasts.